was our dining room. My father, who was a butcher by trade, decided that he would buy the premises because he was quite happy to be a grocer and have a grocer's shop. We'd been there a very short while when the existing butcher died. That would have been Mr. Wyatt, who lived up in Riverside. My father then decided that we really didn't need a dining room anyway, so the wall was knocked down between the dining room and the existing grocery shop, and the right-hand side became a butcher shop.
The grocery kept on.
Oh yes. So therefore, it almost doubled in size. I mean, if you look, it's probably 5/8 and 3/8. But yes, I mean, virtually doubled in size, the shop. And it was one of 4, 5 thriving shops. Post office opposite the George. Mr. and Mrs. Brooks had the country stores, and that was an off license. The post office was also a haberdasher's and whatever. Daddy was a grocer and butcher. Then there was a funny little shop, which I seem to remember was in the garden of the Tudor house. It would have been that. You've got a. Have you come up Workhouse Lane? Beard. There were people called Beard there. Mr. and Mrs. But Colonel and Mrs. Beard. And they had a son called Nicholas. I don't know where Nicholas went to school, but he didn't come to the local school.
And it was a shop.
It was a little shop. And the day I passed my 11 plus, I was allowed the morning off, and I went back, and my father gave me 0.5 crown. And why on earth? Because there wasn't an ounce of tomboy in me, but I bought a penknife. What did I want a penknife for? But I did. That's what I did. How exciting is that? So, and Beards was absolutely amazing, because there was absolutely everything in the world in that shop. And it was jumbled up. I mean, you'd have bed sheets and packets of pin-up perm lotion and, I can't tell you. It was just absolutely amazing.
And presumably Goddard's garage was working
then? Mr. Goddard had a garage and sold petrol, so we really didn't have to leave the village. We had the only thing I suppose we didn't have was a chemist shop. But apart from that, East Meon was really self-sufficient. And on a Friday afternoon, Bert Roberts would come round with a van, and he sold fruit and veg and fish.
Was there then still a building at the end of the post office garden next to Glenthorne, to which a fishmonger came?
I don't remember it.
That's before me.
Yeah. But it wasn't there.
Can I just go back to what Jen was saying there about why Father came to East Meon and not to Selborne? And that's because they'd fixed the flooding in the village. Had they not fixed the flooding in the village, he would have gone to Selborne.
So
this would have been a different story altogether.
No, 1955.
Yes.
That's when they did the work.
Well, 54, I think they did.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They had got down, and they had done that little bit by Corner Cottage and the George, and they were working their way down. But there's no way he would have bought the shop before then.
So moving on, how did you meet?
I came to the village. I was abroad in the RAF, and my father had died, and my mother decided that she would move from where she was to Petersfield to be near friends, old school friends, and she found the place in Temple Lane, which was called Laurel Dean.
Laurel Dean, then.
It was called Laurel Dean, and it had been one of the bungalows that was built for Lady Peel, for her workers. There's three bungalows there, and I can't remember the name of the man who was there before she bought it.
Mr. Blackman, wasn't it?
No, Mr. Blackman had lived there, and then the bloke who came there had done a lot of renovation to it.
Oh.
And then she bought it and moved in there in 1971. I came back in September to this village, which I thought was fantastic. There was all these things happening, all these clubs, everything happening, which was far, far different from the village that I had lived in.
And the fact that there were shops.
There were shops, there were so many societies and things happening.
British
luncheon
Legion
clubs,
guides, brownies, cubs, everything.
It was a real thriving community.
Music groups.
Everything.
Yeah. Tell me, was the chapel in Temple Lane, what sort of chapel was it?
It was a Roman Catholic chapel.
It was already a Roman Catholic.
And it was working as a Roman Catholic chapel. And the Methodist chapel was still running.
Yeah.
So you had those, the church, of course, and there was just so many different things happening in the village.
You've strayed off of how you met me, Frank. Obviously not worth recording.
Well, it was chance meetings in the village where we chatted. The night in question was at a dance up in the George, upstairs in the function room. And Jenny came with somebody and left with me.
As one does.
I'm not sure I like that sort of reputation.
So, and that was 1970?
That must have been about 73, I should think. I came back in 71, but spent a lot of time... I was in the RAF until 73, so I spent a lot of time away. I was down in Dunkerswell, up on the hills above Honiton, and I was also at Henlow.
How did you then come to be a deep sea diver?
Because when I was abroad in Akrotiri, in Cyprus, I became very involved with the Sub Aqua Club and became a BZAC member and spent a lot of my time diving and having jolly times in the clubhouse down there. And I had, I suppose when I left there, I had 18 months, 2 years to go before I came out of the RAF. And I thought, this is what I want to do with my life when I come out. And I went off down the West Country and I toured all the way around looking for a good place to breed lobsters. But it was a jolly good holiday. And I was latterly writing away to Comex, who were down in Marseille in France, who took Scooby-Doos like myself and trained them up in 6 weeks and sent them out saturation diving. And killed them. There was a lot of people who got killed in 73. And I was also used to play rugby. So I played rugby for Petersfield when I came back. And I got cropped. And coming out of that, I had to go to the job centre to come off of sick benefit or whatever it was I was on. And they had a job there, which was actually Vickers Oceanics, submersibles. And basically I applied and joined them.
So you were a deep sea diver until you went to the post office?
I had a heart attack in
1994.
So just about until you went to the post office?
Yes, 95 we took it on.
Yeah.
Well, I was very ill after my heart attack. It was quite a major one. It took me a long time to get myself back together. I mean, I spent a long time lying on sofas in our conservatory and things, and I couldn't do anything. And I slowly got better. And then the post office came up for sale. And I thought, at my age, I didn't want to be on benefits for the rest of my life. And I couldn't really see what else I could do, because I wasn't very well even then. So we took that on, much to Jen's...
My horror.
Let's come back to that, because 73 you were married.
74.
74, and then there was no village hall, there was no institute.
Yes, no. You're right. We got married at the United Reformed Church in Petersfield, because I had been married before, and I had been married in East Meon Church in 1966. And I didn't even ask if I could be married there again, because I'm very much against people actually having two marriage ceremonies in the same church. Because, you know, we've kind of broken the vows a little bit, and I don't think you should even ask, so we didn't. But because Frank had never been married, he didn't want to be married in a registry office. So we went to the Congregational Church, or the United Reformed Church in Petersfield, and we were married there.
And the reception?
The reception was at the Toby Jug. The wedding breakfast was at the Toby Jug restaurant, which was in Dragon Street.
Oh, right.
Lovely, lovely old building, which is still there, but not a restaurant, obviously. The wedding breakfast was there, and then in the evening, John and Margaret Tostevine very kindly lent us the barn at Duncombe. And we had a rip-roaring evening there. It was absolutely first class.
The Millionaires played for us.
Millionaires.
The Millionaires were the local group. With
Leslie Blackman,
Les Blackman,
David Goddard, Tony Pony.
Dennis
Colborne,
was he one?
Dennis Colborne used to sing with them occasionally.
Yes.
Anyhow, that's an indication of the fact that by then the Institute had been
demolished.
And the other thing you were very involved in was fundraising and the whole transition from the Institute to the...
That's right. And that was mostly thanks to John and Pam Sparrow, who were very social people. And we had all sorts of cabarets, even in the old Institute. We had evenings where we would dress up as bunny girls or serving wenches. But food was provided. We served them supper and they sat round in tables and then we danced. And I don't know, it was a little bit of a cabaret, and you would have the Millionaires would perform, Dennis Colborne would sing, Tony Pony would play his guitar, all sorts of... But you know, the only thing I absolutely refused to do, there was a stupid song called My Ding-a-Ling, and we were supposed to walk around the tables with triangles and, you know, singing this ridiculous song. And I said to Pam and the rest of the girls, I am so sorry, I can't do that. I really can't. I can't. But it didn't matter. They just let me stand at the side and watch them. But that's the only thing I ever refused to do.
The rest of the fundraising, I mean, it was an enormous undertaking.
Oh, seriously, yes, let's absolutely. I think, I expect Daddy's and Mrs. Ross, I think it was Mrs. Ross, and did the Then and Now exhibition.
Yes.
And that took place at the village school.
Yes.
So maybe that was around the time when there wasn't...
That was 73.
Indeed. Well, I mean, very, very similar to the work that you're all doing at the moment now. It was East Meon, Old and New and things. I mean, isn't it awful? I was busy. I had a daughter and I didn't actually get involved in the Then and Now. It was my daddy's thing, not mine.
You were hairdressing, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I hairdressed in the village.
Now, tell me about the episode where you were Margaret Pelly.
Yes. We're rolling on a few years now, and Adrian and Margaret Pelly were two people who came to my kitchen to have their hair cut. And on this particular occasion, she said to me, it'll have to be an extra special one this time, and laughed. And I said to her, oh, I said, you're obviously going to meet somebody important. She said, we've got somebody coming for tea. And I thought absolutely nothing of it. And I didn't question it all. We went on to something else and all the rest of it. But it turns out that, of course, because I think Adrian had been... Was he estate manager at Windsor? And, in fact, it was the Queen who was coming to tea. Which I was told that when she came for her next haircut. I'd obviously realised in the meantime, because, you know, rumours spread in a village, don't they? You know, did you know that the Queen went to the Pellys for tea? Well, I didn't, but I knew something was happening. The thing I remember saying to her, now, what on earth do you give the Queen when she comes to tea? And it was, I forget what the sandwiches were, but it was Baron Brit, and it was Victoria sponge cake and this sort of thing, you know. But it was, yes, it Well, what seems like 5 years is probably 15. I'm almost loath to say the early 90s because I'm not convinced. I didn't work after I married Frank. I didn't work. We consequently had two sons. And then he was made redundant twice. And the second time he was made redundant, we had Deborah at the convent, so there were school fees, albeit pretty small, but we had school fees, we had a mortgage, etc., etc. And I said to Frank, well, I guess I'll do the odd haircut in the kitchen. Well, of course, you know, 22 years later, I just had to stop because it was like Topsy. I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous. It grew and it grew.
I've got down here Temple Lane Abattoir. Is it something I've made up?
I know nothing about an abattoir in Temple Lane. No. But I used to go to the abattoir with my father in Petersfield. The abattoir is by where Tesco now is and the Grange Surgery. That was the Grange Surgery and Tesco combined were an enormous abattoir. It was known as the Petersfield Wholesale Meat Company.
If you look at the Riverside stores, and on the right-hand side, it used to be a butcher's.
Where the hatch is.
Where the hatch was, yes. Then there's a little gap, and then there's the barn, and then there's a place where Leal Wyatt drives his car in and parks it into the garages, which goes through to a paddock at the back, or his garden. They used to drive in cow or sheep or what have you into the paddock, and then they would bring it into the end of what is basically was a slaughterhouse there, and they would kill the beast in there, and there's runoff for the blood and everything inside there, and outside the left hand side of the barn, as you look at it, there's a pit underneath that, what is gravel there now, where the blood all used to soak away into. And then there's a door on the side of the barn nearest the butcher's, and they used to carry the carcass through and into the butcher shop.
Now, Lidl's father was a butcher. Was Lidl a butcher too?
No.
So that's when the butcher
He worked
started.
At Barnsley. He was a woodcraftsman.
Yes.
As did my cousin, strangely enough.
Yes.
My cousin was an apprentice at... A paid apprentice at Barnsley.
Mr. Bray, of course.
And Mr. Bray.
His father before him.
Yes.
When did you actually move to Laurel Cottage?
July the 3rd, 1977.
Right. Was that for any particular reason except a bigger house?
Yeah, we rented a farm cottage from Michael Atkinson, and we certainly didn't want to rent property. But it wasn't the way to go.
We were in Michael's for 3 years. Mm-hmm. Now, we were up by South Farm in one of those cottages on the side of the road.
We were up there. Yes. Yes.
And we were paying £7... A month.
A week.
A month.
A week, darling.
A week.
Yes.
A week.
Yes, because it actually, by the time we left, we were paying £40 a month.
Yeah.
For our little farm cottage.
By the way, do you remember much of all the shenanigans of Ruth Blackman selling the land for the new village hall? And
I don't remember. No, I didn't. I wasn't involved. I didn't get involved. But I knew, you know, it was. There's so many things that I've always likened to Clash Merle in East Meon, and it was a Clash Merle moment, put it that way. Yeah.
Certainly, land was owned by, after she died, by descendants, nieces and nephews.
Who weren't in East Meon.
Who lived down in Brighton Way or Hastings or somewhere down there.
One in Italy.
And yes, and they had basically no interest in East Meon whatsoever, and they wanted to build 76 houses there, I think it was, on that ground.
Yeah.
I think they probably wanted 100 and something on there to begin with.
As I say, Clough Mill, all over again.
You were also involved with was when East Meon was declared the Doomsday
village. Yes.
And did you organise the medieval banquet?
Well, that all stemmed really from the fact that a committee was formed because the Doomsday year, Winchester were holding this exhibition, and part of the exhibition, this village of East Meon in the time of the Doomsday was created, and then people were going to be pointed to East Meon to go and look at what was there now. And the general consensus was that we were going to make some money out of it. So this committee was formed, and they would talk about having jousting and having Morris dancers and et cetera, et cetera,
et cetera. Dennis was going to have a joust at Queen Elizabeth Park, wasn't he?
Basically, it didn't happen. However, the headmaster at the time of the school, Wynne Lewis, put together an absolutely marvellous event whereby the school was transformed into a castle. They had the old lorry canvases hanging down the front of the school with castellations above, and the main hall was full of straw and straw bales. And round the back they had knights' tents and things and what have you, and all sorts of things going on. The elder children were knights and ladies, and the younger one were serfs and what have you. And we had visiting schools coming all week who were Saxons. Ours were Normans. And they were Saxons, and they had to pay homage to our school, which was all jolly good. And then they had great sort of banquets round the back and in the hall.
And Wynne Lewis had chainmail.
The banquet itself was in the village hall, judging by the photographs.
I then got annoyed, rather annoyed. I shouldn't say that in front of this, but nothing was happening. Nothing was happening in the village to celebrate this other than the headmaster. So I borrowed the shields and I borrowed the flags that they had and went down to the village hall and put them all up there. And originally it was a fundraising event, but we didn't get enough people. But it was just right for the event that occurred, because everybody sat round the outside of a horseshoe type thing. We found this marvellous group called Machine Without Horses, who juggled and ate fire and
through fire
and music.
Yes,
music taking part, you know, and what have you. And we had about five or six courses, and we had serving wenches who was Greta.
Greta Tubb and Julie Cannings and two or three others.
We've got photographs of them.
Yes,
somewhere.
Again, we've got photographs.
Mm. And it was such a marvellous evening. Everybody wanted another one. So we did another one without actually trying to make any money or anything like that, just to enjoy the following year.
Peter Wadsworth was Lord of the Manor.
Yes. Okay, so which comes next, the Sexton or the post office?
Sexton.
The Sexton. I'd been heavily involved with looking after a portion of the churchyard which had been set up by Chris Brough, and he'd got a number of people from the village to look after small bits of the churchyard. I used to go away for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, and through the growing season I used to get really annoyed because I'd come back and it would be nearly waist high, so I'd have to start all over again and cut it. Now my bit was the new grave area, which is a bit smaller at that in those days, down the west end. Anyway, I had my heart attack and finished working offshore, and about the same time things had just got very lax in the churchyard. Chris Brough, I think, had gone away. He'd lost his son. He and his wife had gone off to France. It needed someone to look after the churchyard. Not that I was capable at that time, but a sort of year or so later, the churchyard had just gone to a wilderness. There was trees growing and stuff because they decided that it was probably better left to nature, which to somebody who doesn't know anything about the looking after the land sounded like a good idea, I guess. They just did the little billiard table at the front of the church. And then I suggested to Peter Wadsworth that it actually needed looking after. So we set up a charity to collect money to pay somebody to cut the grass. So we actually had some volunteers still around who were volunteering to cut odd bits. And we also paid those to do those areas that we couldn't do.
Your trustees were John Rendell and Susan Dummer Morgan.
Well, then somebody came down on us and said, what's going to happen with the money you're collecting?
What?
Are you going to start a charity so that the money's put away safely?
Quite right, too.
And I hadn't thought about this, but I thought, well, yes, better do, I suppose. So they all know that their money's not being put in my pocket and down to the local pub.
Yeah.
So we set up Sexton and John Rendell to represent the church, Susan Delmar Morgan to represent the wildlife side of things, and me to represent the village, as it
were. There never was a sexton.
There was a sexton in Jen's time, but
Frank Collier.
So he must have lived opposite you in Haycroft.
He did.
Very surprisingly, we had this art exhibition. We had coffee. And the first one raised an enormous amount of money. Well, we thought it was enormous at the time. It was well over £1,000.
Plus.
£1,700 or something
like
that.
And these were paintings done by villagers, hung in the village hall and sold.
It was supposed to be local, local artists. And
it also included a couple of our friends, Gordon Rushmer being one.
Gordon Rushmer helped me to start it, really, because I went to him and I said, what do you think? Can we do this? Would it be a viable thing to do? And he said, yes, he thought it was, and that he would put in a few pictures, and he came along and helped me to set it all up. And he sold quite a few pictures, didn't he, on that occasion?
Yes.
I always remember the first picture we sold. Bun Roper was an artist in her own right, but had taken to going to art classes at the age of 70-something, but had been quite a good artist in her own right. And she gave us a picture, of which didn't really mean terribly much to us, but it was a scene, and as it turned out, it was looking down across a farm across to Selborne. And Mr. Hewlett, who lived in Temple Lane, who was a friend of Jen's father, he lived in Belmont Terrace.
Oh, yeah.
Then he was an AI man, doing AI work for I can't remember his
Mark
name.
Mark Beach.
Mark Beach, who owned this farm there. And he walked into the hall with Mr. Hewlett, Mark Beach did, and he looked across the hall and he says, I'll have that picture.
It was his farm.
And it was his farm. It was from high up on a hill.
When did you give up the Sexton's charity?
It sort of gave me up. The church became more involved in what it was doing. I mean, it was set up really to look after the church, but to keep it out of the hands of the church, who would be quite happy to do their billiard table bit round the church and leave everything else. We'd set it up as a village charity and not a church charity. And but most of the effort of it went into looking after the churchyard.
Yeah.
And then when they sort of became more involved in what they wanted to do in the churchyard and what have you, and they wanted to manage what they wanted to do, so it became obvious that it was better for them to run their own payment and things for what it was. And in the end, we passed on all our monies to them and all our equipment and stuff.
So it wasn't when you came to Petersfield, it was before that?
It was before then, yes.
Okay. And then the post office was 95 as well. They really both about the same time, weren't they?
Yeah, October 95 we took on the post office.
From Judy Barber.
From Judy Barber.
Had she set up at Riverside already, or did you move it to Riverside?
She... No, she worked for Mrs. Emtage. And when the post office closed there, and it became a private house, and East Meon was without a post office, and Judy Barber went up to Leo Wyatt to see whether there was a place there that she could use. And she went into what was the old sitting room in the front bit, which was a house in its own right. If you look at Leo Wyatt's, there's two houses there.
Yes.
Sort of joined together. She set up there as a post office, went in through the front door, turned left, went down the steps into the post office. Harold Bennett bought the milk round, and he came up and he started his milk round, and the fridges for the milk round were down the side of the Riverside stores, really, just to the right, against the old barn.
Yes.
On the right there. And he decided that he wanted to take out some goodies on his round with him.
This was so what, the 1980s?
Yes, it would have been. Late
80s. Yeah. He went to Leo and said, could he open the shop as a dairy shop, as it were, with a few bits and pieces in it and what have you. And he then utilised that to take stuff out on his rounds, and people got used to the fact that he could bring them bread and as well as the milk, you know, all sorts of bits. So hence that started. A number of years go by and Harold has a heart attack. And I actually ended up going out on a round with Dennis Eames to...
And Alistair. Alistair was there. It was Alistair that contacted us. He was earning money because he was at a college. Mm.
And I can remember going around these houses, and it would be the house with the green door. And then the next house would be the house with the black dog.
In his milk book.
In his milk book. So I'm looking and trying to work out where the black dog is. So he has a heart attack, and Judy Barber then takes on the whole shop from Harold.
So the sort of early 90s.
Yes.
So the post office having closed in the meantime.
Yes, yes.
So we then take over the post office and the shop from Judy.
Do you remember whether there was any question then of the post office going to East Meon stores?
No, there was no question of anywhere.
There seemed to be any question of it.
No. It was just going to be lost.
Mm. So you took it over from Judy in 95.
Yeah.
And ran it for...
until 2002. Basically, Lille didn't want us there anymore. I think he wanted to sell. That's what he told us anyway. And he pinned us down. We had a 5-year lease, and then he pinned us down to a 6-month lease, and it just... I mean, we had to pay for Christmas things 9 months beforehand, etc. So consequently, it just wasn't workable.
Yeah. It was let's be honest, it was almost a financial disaster.
Yeah.
So, you know, it took it on to sort of give you something to do because you didn't want stress in your life. And we've got, Dennis, of course, did a video.
Yes.
In the millennium of a working day in the shop. And it's wonderful because there's villagers and there's dear old Wilson who calls me ducks and just fantastic stories. Lovely video.
Are there any other villagers that I think made a real impression on you over the years?
I think there were two sisters called Clara and Dorothy Fisher. Clara and I think she was Dorothy, she was known as Dolly, but Clara and Dorothy Fisher. And they lived in Templar's Brow. Yes, Templar's Brow.
Yes.
And they had, their father was alive. I can still remember their father. Bob Fisher. And he rang the bells, literally, until almost, I was going to say, the day he died. I can imagine he rung them Sunday morning and died on Sunday afternoon. He was an amazing elderly man. He really was. I'm not sure what he did, and I'd be guessing, and I don't do guess. But Claire and Dorothy, Claire Fisher in particular, had had a fascinating life. She had been a nanny to the...
King of Siam.
The King of Siam? No, the governor. The child she was nanny to.
Something to do with children. Siam.
Anyway, definitely involved in Siam. So, you know, from East Mian, she actually ended up in the Far East. And I don't think Dorothy probably left the village. Her sister, Dorothy probably didn't leave the village more than six times in her life.
She wasn't quite the full shilling.
And the Kills you knew well.
George Kill, I used to talk over the fence in the evening, discussing people he knew and things that happened in the village and bygone years. Yes,
he'd lived in our house when he was young. He'd lived in Laurel Cottage when he was young.
That was there. Family house. The Kills back then in the 30s, 40s, owned our house. They owned the field that went all the way up to Temple Lane and the barn that was up on Temple Lane where Belmont Terrace is now built, only it was nearer the road, if you follow what I mean. Where Mrs. Kill and Mr. Kill ended their Mr. Kill ended his days in the bungalow that's next to Laurel Cottage.
Yeah.
That used to be an old tumble-down cottage, and I forget the name of it now, and they owned that, which George eventually knocked down. Well, they were made to knock it down by the council because the chimney was very unsafe. But he built his bungalow there when he got married. They owned across the road a big house there, opposite Laurel Cottage.
It was a big house.
It was a big house called...
I think it was Kilburn House.
Kilburn House.
I've got an idea it was Kilburn.
I've got a picture of it in here. It was half again as big, I think, as Laurel Cottage. They owned what was the Old Angel pub down the cross, which was three cottages. Which they were renowned for... it being very shabby and being poor owners. And the cottages that were down Workhouse Lane, the thatch one, they were given to the Portsea and what have you as sort of council houses type thing.
Now tell me, your road, Chapel Street,
yes.
It gets its name from what?
You got Kilburn House,
yeah,
and then you had three or four... terraced cottages, and at the end of it there was a chapel, and it was a very, very severe Puritan chapel, which I can't remember the name, but it's in, I've got it somewhere.
Is that where the school now is?
No, it's where the lay-by is. So if you went up the lay-by, where the school is was a field.
Yes.
Do you know, I didn't know that.
What?
That there'd been a chapel there.
Yeah.
I mean, I
hence
know.
Chapel Street.
Indeed, I can see it now. But so, why was it called the Alley?
Because that's what it used to be called. It was Halley's Street. Chapel Street used to be called Halley Street. When I came, anyway, I don't know when Jen came, because you can remember those cottages there, can't you?
No, they'd gone before we came.
Because Arthur Newbury's father used to live in one of them. And also, where Flint Cottage is, you know, where John Day was in.
Yeah.
And you come past and then there's two bungalows. Yeah? There was four terrace houses, cottages, running inwards, in going in. So they weren't running with the road, but they were running in along. Yes. Yeah. So their gardens came along the back, and there's a well that goes down in the middle of...
Shirley Kitter's mother lived there, and her grandmother. And Mary Crockford's mother-in-law.
Good old Herbie Goddard.
Oh, yes.
Herbie, yeah, he was nice. He was I told you the story before that he'd came up through Italy in the war, and he actually managed to get an audience with the Pope, which impressed him so much that he decided that he would bend his life to East Meon for the rest of his life and try and do everything that he could. And I think, in the main, he did. He was called, in inverted commas, the mayor, and I think he really lived up to that.
But he was chair of both the village hall committee and the
parish council.
Was he? Interesting.
At the time when the parish
council,
at the time the village hall was being developed, so he was able to ensure that some funds got
yes.
there. Now the other name I got down is Ethel Lambert.
Yes, she lived in the almshouse that I think it's the one that Mrs. Butler is now in,
yes,
next to
right.
Nuneaton.
Yes.
That side, as it were, the first one. Yes. So you've got the post office that was. Then you have Nuneaton House.
Yes.
Where Ruth Blackman lived.
Yes.
And then you have the two almshouses that lay back on the right.
Yes.
Cottages, bungalows, really.
Built a bit.
Single story, yes. And Mrs. Ethel Lambert, I'm sure, lived in the first one. And there were people called Merritt who lived next door. And Ethel Lambert was the dearest, dearest person. And it was her daughter Marjorie, of course, who later became very well known in the village for her...
And she had an aunt as well.
Altruistic ways.
So it's Ethel Lambert's sister who lived in the same house as what Marjorie lived in.
Miss Roach.
Miss Roach. And she was blind, but she knitted us the most amazing...
Alistair had a wonderful shawl.
And she was blind.
Gosh.
It's like a cobweb.
And before them, there were this is way before your time, but three Lamberts were farmers in East Meon in the First War.
They were, and I know nothing about them at all.
No.